ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Anne Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
What is happening inside Iran, the other player in this on-off super high-stakes drama in the Middle East? Does anyone really know?
Yes, while most attention in the West is on Trump and his woes, who's really calling the shots and the missiles inside Iran itself?
They certainly look to have the, forgive me, Trump card, but could they actually face a bigger threat from dissent within? I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. Let's go roaming. Well, you know, Latika, I think a lot of listeners are probably like me. You sort of keep some eye on these ongoing discussions about the Straits of Hormuz, but basically you've decided it's not going to be solved easily and you can't waste too much energy on it. Is that how you're seeing it? I mean, is it still centre frame for you?
Geraldine, it is insofar as will this war be resolved and what does this mean for US strategic interests, but I must admit, I am really struggling to keep up with it because every single day it's the strait is open, no it's not, the blockade is on, they're charging tolls, hang on, a ship has got through, no one's been attacked. I am actually just finding it like a frayed rug and all the threads have unravelled and I can no longer put any of them back together.
Yes, I agree completely. And you just don't know who's got any authority where. You know, it was interesting hearing Trump, and this is what we're going to talk about in our episode, Trump in that sort of weary way that Trump can speak when you feel he might be saying something that he really cares about. He sort of said, I'm low-keying, I think was the word, relations. Yes. They've got all sorts of worries. And he said it in that way, and I thought, you know, he just could be right here. I mean, meanwhile, the Iranian officials are laying out sort of tough demands for reopening the straits, and they don't seem to be breaking apart themselves, which is what has prompted us to think, what the heck is going on inside Iran? Who's got the authority? But they're sort of also working. You'll hear quite a lot of discussion about an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, which seems to be a bit of a marker boy.
Well, this is a blast from the past. I mean, it was only in June. Let's get rid of that word MOU. Let's call it essentially a bit of a tentative truce agreement, which the United States and Iran struck in June. And essentially, this was the precursor to what would be a giant deal. And that one would solve nuclear and all the outstanding issues. But for now, this agreement that they signed was about, okay, let's get the strait reopened. The US will drop the blockade. We'll cease all the military action in Lebanon, et cetera, et cetera. That has completely fallen apart. On Iran's hand, is it the case that, well, we have got the most vital choke point that we can just shut with a cheap drone? Any other day, we can lob something at a commercial vessel and send everyone into a frenzy, which is what happens. And we've got you over a barrel, the United States. That's essentially where we're at. And it's really, really difficult to know how much of this is bluff and how much of this is an indicator of where we might find the war resolving itself, if at all.
Yes, it is a sort of a game being played when wars are not obviously won. And this has most definitely happened at, you know, other times in history. But it does make this question of who then can we look to imagine they do have real influence inside Iran. Now, it's always been a notoriously difficult place to report, which is why we're so happy to have our guest today, Arash Azizi. Now, he is based in Brooklyn. He's an American-Iranian historian. He's very well informed. He's written several books on Iran, including What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. He's got a doctorate in history and Middle East studies from New York University, and he contributes to a range of outlets. We spoke to him back in March, and he was very perceptive and prescient with his judgments. We're delighted to have him back on the program. Arash Azizi, welcome to Global Roaming. Welcome back.
It's great to be with you. It's great to be back.
There's so much we don't know about what's underway in Iran, whereas we hear a lot about the chaos in the Trump administration. So what is going on there? I mean, are you confident you know who is leading, who is making the decisions?
Yes, to a degree. I mean, I think the National Security Council, this body of 13 military political leaders, is obviously sort of calling the shots. Ali Bhaf, who's the Speaker of the Parliament, is the strongest figure there. And then there's the Supreme Leader and his office. And, you know, they have a role. And nominally is, of course, Supreme Leader who calls the shots. But I think it's the National Security Council. So we have some sort of a collective military political leadership who make the decisions. And yes, who exactly makes what decisions can sometimes be unclear. I mean, I don't think there's a case of huge infighting or anything like that. I think it's clear that these figures work on based on some sort of a consensus, and they make these decisions that they've have so far in the last few months. You know, they've tried to fight with the U.S. sometimes to deal with it, go diplomatically, they've led deals with it. And there are people who speak for the regime as a whole, like Araghchi, the foreign minister, you know, Ghalibaf, they've given repeated media interviews. So it's clear that this bunch of characters are now in charge. That much is clear to me.
And what is their leaning? What exactly is the view, if there is a consensus among them, about how much they think they can extract from America before, say, they open the Strait of Hormuz?
That's a very good question. I think they have strategic reevaluations every once in a while. I think, like a lot of others, not clear always how President Trump makes his decisions. The policy process, you know, it's a bit gone. The president seems to make different decisions, you know, every day. And I think there are different strategic considerations. But I think generally, I would say, Latika, that there is a bit of a pessimism about the United States. And they think, you know, Iran establishment has always had those who want to get a rapprochement with the U.S., and those who want to fight it, right? Those who want to go to war with it and those who want to somehow deal with it. But even those who want to deal with it, I think sometimes are pessimistic that they can get a lasting deal from the U.S. and that weakens their hand.
And is that something Trump specific or is that an ongoing trend that's just exacerbated?
I think it's ongoing because they've dealt with Trump, they've dealt with Democrats, they've had different problems with Democrats. So look, if I want to speak generally, I think there are still important tendencies in the Iranian establishment of those who want to find a way to deal with the United States, to have the sanctions lifted on an economy so that they could pursue a path of economic development. I think Ghalibaf ultimately belongs to this camp. I think the age of Khamenei, the ideologue who wanted to fight the United States and Israel on a sort of ideological basis is gone. I think you have a bunch of much more dour military figures who look at things from a military strategic point of view, not ideological point of view. And I think a lot of them do want to get to some sort of economic development, but I'm not sure enough of them will be able to bring about this change because, you know, part of the issue is also that it will be a huge shift and everyone's worried of who's going to come off where this change happens, right? If you do move to deal with the U.S., get a peace with the U.S. and all that, can everyone preserve their privileges, move to the next stage, or will it create some sort of an instability that would let them lose their seats? So what we have is a terrible situation of stasis, really. It's a situation of, you know, we're in an interregnum where the country is suffering terribly from the blockade, from the continued economic decline, from this no peace, no war situation is absolutely terrible. And yet there doesn't seem to be enough of a strong will at the top on part of Ghalibaf or others to make swift changes that are necessary.
So there's, in its own way, there's no risk-taking there. There's nobody brilliant likely to sort of branch out. Is that what you're suggesting?
Exactly. I mean, that so far has been the case. Now, we could be surprised, you know, a week later, there might be that some people are able to bring about this will and make those swift changes. Look, this happens a lot when grand dictators die, right? If you look at how China was when Mao Zedong died in 1976, you know, it was a few years before someone like Deng Xiaoping came along and took the country on a bold sort of capitalist path. Mm. After the death of Stalin, it took a few years until you have someone like Khrushchev, and then he was in power for a while, and then others. And we can bring sort of other examples, right? So, I mean, sometimes it takes a little while after grand figures like Khamenei, dictator who really defined an entire era. It takes a little while for the future path of the regime to be clear. But I'll tell you this, it's these conditions of, the current conditions are very hard to continue in.
What do you mean by that? What current conditions? Spell them out exactly.
Well, there's a blockade enforced by the U.S. and the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is closed, but Iran also gets hurt by this closure, right? It can't sell its oil. It has tons of other problems. Imagine economically planning for anything in Iran. Economic health, first of all, depends on planning, right? How can you plan anything in Iran? How can you can't even open a bakery easily next week because, how do you know what's going to be what? Who's going to be in charge? How are things going to close or not?
Well, that's interesting because Trump has been saying this exactly. Well, I'm just going to wait and see. Their economy is suffering. Is he right?
Yeah, he's right there. He's right there. Absolutely, he's right because, I live in the United States. Yes, the war has caused some instability here, but obviously it's nothing comparable. Iran is suffering terribly economically. And yet it has a regime that for so long has never cared about the benefits of its people. It knows most of its people hate it anyways. So, it starts from a low bar there.
You're listening to Global Roaming with Latika Burke and Geraldine Duke. We're talking to prominent American-Iranian historian Arash Azizi about the situation inside Iran.
So, therefore, does that suggest the people who are starting to write, and you're one of them, that internal dissent is still actually the biggest single threat to that regime, such as it is at the moment? It's just so hard, in a way, from the outside to believe that, because they're so tough. As you say, they continue to wage war on their citizens. And it's so dangerous to really come out against them.
Look, I'm not suggesting that it's easy at all for Iranian citizens to overthrow their regime or anything like that. But still, if a government has to go out, execute so many of its own citizens, crack down every so often on its population, that's no easy way of governing either. So that's what I'm suggesting. And of course, at some point, things might also change in a more sort of dramatic way.
But like what? What do you mean by that?
You might have grand uprisings. You might have internal divisions in the regime being affected by this, right? You might have sections of the establishment who rely on parts of the population to push away for the other sections. I mean, different things can happen. But there is a lot of political instability and economic instability. The thing that is kind of interesting here is that the Islamic Republic is great at managing instability, frankly. It's done that, the history of Islamic Republic is like one crisis after the other. It's almost the other way around that's their problem. I mean, that shows why they're hesitant in signing deals and stuff. I think they're worried about what would we do if things are normal. that's harder for them to imagine than having a crisis because they look like they've weathered a crisis. They're sort of a wartime government in many ways, and they're able to go forward. They're able to keep power. And that's not so easy if the conditions are normal. I think they're sometimes more afraid of that. And that explains why, look, the MOU, and the entire world said the MOU was a great achievement. They got a deal that they couldn't have dreamed of before the war. So why ruin it? Why not settle on it? And I think the answer is that they just were afraid of moving toward more normalized governance.
That's fascinating. So how do you put into that context this new demand for reconstruction funding from the United States? Do you think that's a tactic, or is it a sign that Iran feels it has the upper hand?
No, it's not a new demand. They've always said it, and it's also the most, it's what everyone says, right? After every war, it's sort of a demand you have. You say, pay us to compensation for the war. And it's not a serious demand. Iranians know they're not going to get, compensation in a war like that. But it's possible for them to get is that if they give up the nuclear program, they can hope to get sanctions relief and some sort of foreign investment. That is something that they can hope to get. But the onus is on Tehran to want to say to its region and to the world that, look, we want to try a different path. We want to prioritize economic development. But, it takes a shift that we haven't seen yet. The priority of the regime has for so long not. There's a battle that they say they want economic development, but the actions that they take, it's more sort of military adventures. And now with the two wars that US and Israel have waged on Iran in 2 years, unfortunately, if you're getting to this train where, you know, Iran sees itself as a victim of these wars and, you know, it keeps wanting to wage wars against all of its neighbors, all of whom are aligned with the US in some way or the other. And now we have an inking of a new deal between Turkey, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, the sort of Mecca defense agreement.
Well, that's been signed. That was my next question. How are they going to react to this?
That was my next question too, Geraldine. Battling to ask the same question.
Go ahead, Latika.
How have the Iranians responded to the inking of this deal? Do they take it seriously? And also, what is your interpretation of what it means?
Iran has tried to appear cool and nonchalant almost. They've tried to be like, well, this is not really about us. If anything, they've even tried to put a positive spin on it by saying, well, this shows that Turkey, Pakistan, Saudis understand that the security will come from the region, not from outside, not from the US. But it's that's a lot of coping, to be honest. It's very clear what's happening here, that major Muslim countries in the region with whom Iran has had excellent ties, like Turkey and Pakistan, which are very important, long-lasting cultural ties with Iran, cultural religious ties with Iran, they have now come to close to Saudi Arabia, all of whom, and Egypt is likely to join them as well. All of these countries are Western aligned, and they've understood that Iran represents a threat to them. And there's a tradition going back to the 1950s, really. It used to be called the Northern tier countries, Iran, Pakistan, Turkey, you know, Iraq at some point was part of it. Political developments in Iran and Iraq took them out. But these countries are countries that are Western aligned, you know, massive economies and militaries coming together to bolster the regional order. So in a way, this is a return to that tradition. There was the Baghdad Pact in 1955. Later on, it was called the CENTO. And in many ways, that's a return to that tradition. It doesn't augur well for Iran. It signals further isolation of Iran. Iran thought that out of this war, it could somehow push the US out of the region. But if anything, it has had more countries in the region coming close to each other against Iran's revisionism, effectively. Because look, the other countries in the region now, they have a consensus. What do they want? They want economic development, ties with each other, end of the civil wars, end of their attempts to change the ideological nature of regimes.
And what about Israel? Are they prepared to let, you know, have this greater Middle East, which includes Israel, or not?
Well, Israel, it's interesting. So the Mecca Pact is also bad news for Israel in a way. Israel for so long has lived in a fantasy. It's a terrible fantasy in which it will continue to occupy Palestinian land. It will then continue to kill thousands of Palestinians with impunity. And somehow it will also get recognition and normalization, and it would be sort of accepted as a country by its Arab neighbors. Under Netanyahu, there was an Israeli journalist who called it cakeism, you know, having your cake and eating it too. The idea that it could not to do anything with the Palestinians, continue to occupy them, deny them a state, and also get recognition. And for a while, Netanyahu seemed to get it, especially with the Abraham Accords of 2020. But Saudi Arabia is key here. Saudi Arabia has always been clear that they would not normalize relations with Israel unless they open pathways to the formation of a Palestinian state. And yet Israel acts against Saudi Arabia, acts against Turkey, a country with which it has diplomatic relations. Frankly, Turkey has been responsible for saving thousands of Israeli lives in many ways, even though they don't have good sort of political relations. And yet Israel sort of speaks out against it like it's an enemy. So I think the Israeli government under Netanyahu has had a terribly short-sighted, and it sort of has been a truly bad actor from the perspective of the region. Now, there are elections in Israel. If the next government wants to act differently, that's something that we have to see. If the next government will understand and reprioritize Israel's own interests, think, okay, we have neighbors like Egypt and Jordan with whom we have diplomatic relations, and what can we do to be part of this regional consensus? Right now, Geraldine, let me put it in this way. The Lebanese leader, Waleed Jambalat, like to say that Lebanon finds itself between Karbala and Masada. Karbala is a holy city for the Shias in Iraq, and Masada is obviously a holy site in Israel, you know, that has its connotations of messianic fighting. So, you know, the idea is that Iran and Israel, you know, in the region are, from the perspective of most of the region, are the two sort of bad actors in a way that don't join this regional consensus for economic development and for an end to warfare. And Netanyahu said that, you know, for all generations, they'll need to just continue fighting. And Iran also refuses to accept Israel's existence, continues to threaten it with destruction and you know, have this very unhelpful behavior. I think the interest of Arab countries and others like the MECA Pact is to seek a regional order. And I believe Israelis are entirely, it's entirely possible for Israelis to also join this regional order. They'll need to make different decisions. And I think the next, it's likely that when Netanyahu is gone, the next government in Israel, if you're a bit optimistic, by someone like Gadi Eisenkot, for example, can very much do that. President Trump hasn't been always helpful also with lack of a strategic vision and being absent on those grand strategic questions.
Just getting back inside Iran, I also read about ongoing issues around women's clothing, that this is in fact possibly the sort of culture war in a giant fashion, and that this splits people in governance and it prevents them thinking these bigger thoughts that you're talking about, let alone being, you know, appalling. Now, how do you read that? Is that an ongoing sort of sore point that can't be easily overcome?
Look, the Islamic Republic has for so long been based on a few axes, if you will, few fundamentals. One of the fundamentals of the Islamic Republic is that we're going to make society look like our ideal Islamic society in which women are covered up. And that vision is gone. They failed big time because these Iranian women, like most human beings everywhere in the world, don't like to be told what to do. And when they were forced to don the hijab, they've effectively revolted against the hijab. And the last few years, the Islamic Republic made a decision to not enforce the hijab because it knew that it wants to enforce the hijab every day. Basically, it has to fight every day. So now, if you go to the streets of Tehran, you know, you'll see people in tank tops, which was unimaginable, you know, in my day. Nothing like that. You know, people didn't even dress like that inside homes when I was young in Iran. So it's a huge, massive cultural defeat for the Islamic Republic. And there are sore elements who want to overcome it. And they want to come back and reinforce Islamic dress as they understand it.
So there's still enormous amounts of energy, is there, being expended on this business of trying to make the women's hijab almost the marker boy of whether they've succeeded. I mean, this is an own goal, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, you have to look at it from their perspective, right? From the perspective of 1979 revolution, what was the 1979 revolution about, right? One of its goals was to Islamicize Iranian society. So no, from their perspective, the fact that hijab is not being enforced is a problem, and that they would need to enforce it with brutality, with any brutality that it takes, because these are the goals. They believe God has told them to bring about this kind of society. And just like in Afghanistan, Taliban has done so, just like ISIS tried to do it when it held power in Iraq and Syria, it's the exact same idea. They believe this is how godly society should look like, and they'll stop at nothing at enforcing it. I will tell you this, though. People who think like that are now a minority even in the establishment. I think the establishment of the Islamic Republic understand this to be stupid a little bit, frankly, because they understand that, look, what they want is preservation of power for themselves and their privileges, and they understand that trying to bring about this sort of Islamic changes and this sort of Islamist vision for society is a fool's errand, because they would have to spend tons of energy doing it. And, you know, we have to fight tens of millions of women every day. They don't want to do that. Nevertheless, their narrative for rule has always been our great Islamic Republic. What are they going to do with, this is a contradiction for them. What are they going to do with Ayatollah Khamenei? Ayatollah Khamenei was very clear. Hijab mattered. It had to be enforced. Politically, it mattered. Religiously, it mattered. It was a sign of anti-Western sort of resistance, and it had to be enforced. So, you know, Geraldine, this is a good way to understand the whole deal, right? The dilemma of the men currently ruling the Islamic Republic. Either they have to say, look, our entire ideology was a little BS, and, you know, we have to get away from it and reinvent themselves, or they have to try to enforce it, which is very hard. And that's not just an hijab.
Arash, to come back to the immediate question of how the war might end or not, where do you think it goes from here?
You know, we are in a very low intensity stage right now, right? Unfortunately, this could go on for years. You could have years of low intensity conflict between Iran and the US, that, you know, Iran closes the strait, it hits ships here and there. Or you could have a very swift conclusion to it in a couple of months, a couple of weeks even in some ways. So unfortunately, it's a bit hard to predict. But I can tell you, in order to not be a total cop-out out of your question, I can tell you some things. The current establishment in Iran is still beholden to the MOU. They consider it an achievement. They consider it sort of a framework that they can work around. So there might be that this deal with Oman goes through soon. So they have a way of reopening the Strait of Hormuz, and they'll have a way of concluding the war with the US and even coming to some sort of a diplomatic deal with it. Then there's the question of Israel, of course, which continues to have serious worries. But if Iran can come to an agreement with the US regarding its nuclear program, it might also stave Israel off its back for a while. So it's entirely possible that we see this diplomatic path succeed, but it's also possible that this low-intensity war will continue for years to come, and Iran would be sort of like Iraq in the 1990s, a sad, poor place that gets poorer by the day, less stable by the day, and it sort of hobbles along the road. You know, like Iraq was under Saddam Hussein in the 1990s. Don't forget, you know, Iraq suffered an enormous defeat in the war of 1991, and yet it went on until the United States decided to overthrow Saddam in 2003. And if they hadn't, maybe he would have even lasted longer. So unfortunately, the very dreary image of a country wasting its resources on being unable to make bold decisions and continuing with its wrong policies for a very long time is in the Middle East, sadly, it's a very it's very much a possibility.
Arash, we can hear your phone. Is it?
No, sorry, it's not a phone. It's an ice cream truck.
Oh, it is the ice cream truck.
Yes, okay. Brooklyn is a crazy place.
You're with the ice cream truck in the background from Brooklyn. Thanks, Arash Azizi.
Take care, guys.
That's Arash Azizi. He's an American-Iranian historian. He's written several books on Iran, including What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. Well, he's a very good analyst, don't you think, Latika? I enjoy hearing him. He always casts it in a broader context. And, you know, I sort of found myself thinking, my God, where is their Deng Xiaoping? That's what they need right now, somebody who can invigorate the place and who's got enough authority to really take them into some sort of new era.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the best reads of what's going on inside the Iranian regime I've heard anywhere or read anywhere. So great one for global roaming, Geraldine.
Indeed so. Now, look, as we're going to air, of course, all sorts of extraordinary things are underway in FIFA, given our conversation last week about the state of FIFA governance and world soccer. Alana has written in about our episode with the proposed sell-off of FIFA. This is what she thinks. I loved the episode. I think the broader argument about resisting the Americanization of the game is absolutely legitimate. But I also found myself wondering whether there was another layer to what happened. Perhaps this was one of those rare moments where people outside the US were given an opportunity to exercise some influence, to collectively reject something associated with Trump, and in doing so, feel like they had a small measure of agency. I do wonder whether maybe it was the world's way of finally saying enough, or perhaps more bluntly, collective F you, if you will.
Well, seeing as money is the currency of the game, I think Alana's right on it, Geraldine.
Now, you're actually doing something different. You're going off to Norway to an energy conference.
In a couple of weeks, yes, ONS in Stavanger. I'm actually not sure how to say it properly.
Stavanger, I think it is.
Stavanger, yes. You're absolutely right. So I'm going there for an ONS energy conference. I think I'm moderating or chatting to about four different people. So it will be quite interesting.
We shall expect reports back. Not quite your normal geopolitical patch, but vital to it. Vital, absolutely. Look, do keep your questions and feedback coming. We love hearing from you and sort of being prompted by you. And you'll see some stories coming up soon that you did prompt, actually. So our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Thanks to our producer, Aston Brown, supervising producer, Pat Sunderland, and executive producer, Laura McAuliffe. Latika and Kylie will be back with you again tomorrow talking about the AI-fueled rise of the abuse of women in public office,
topical.
Latika.
Yes.
Very interesting, and how that's affecting democracy around the world. So bye-bye for now, Latika.
See you, Geraldine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.